Well, hi, everybody. I made the mistake of getting to know Gretchen Handwerger early in our college career, and she has been giving me jobs ever since. So this afternoon she said, would you introduce Carl Levin, please? And I thought, sure, I know Carl, and I've got a couple of stories that he'd rather I didn't tell. So no problem. But, you know, without putting a damper on things, it's not an easy job to introduce somebody of Carl's stature and ability in this sort of desert, political desert, having somebody with courage of convictions, with honesty and directness, and we know where he stands. That seems like such a treasure that it deserves more than a kind of set of flip remarks about pranks that he played in college, of which there were many. To help me out, I think Carl wrote a 3-page news release about himself, and so I'm going to crib from it. Some of it will be biographical, and you know most of it. Hometown, Detroit, graduate of Detroit Central High School, Swarthmore College, and Harvard Law School. Named Assistant Attorney General and General Counsel of the Michigan Civil Rights Commission in 1964. Elected to the Detroit City Council, elected to the United States Senate in 1978. Re-elected in 1984, 1990, 1996, 2002, 2008, 2014, 2020. In some quarters, he will be best known, and the television folks are among them, as chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee and also the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations of the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. He has received a number of awards and honors. I won't read them because I'm not sure they were all deserved. One of the things that he did, get named to was by Time magazine several years ago as one of America's 10 best senators. The Jackson City Patriot. Now, I suspect that's Jackson, Mississippi, but I'm not sure. The Jackson Citizen Patriot says, Carl Levin is the sort of politician you have to admire, even if you do not always agree with him. He is someone who represents, I think, what this institution is trying hard to accomplish, providing students with experiences that will translate into civic contribution, into personal growth, into a life that enriches the culture of the communities in which we find ourselves. So I'm privileged to make this introduction, and I will make only one other quote before I finish from the Time magazine coverage of his selection. No one would accuse Carl Levin of looking like Hollywood's version of a United States senator. He's pudgy, balding, occasionally rumpled, and he constantly wears his glasses on the very tip of his nose. Still, that Michigan Democrat has gained respect from both parties for his attention to detail and deep knowledge of policy, especially in his role as a vigilant monitor of business and federal agencies. He is a kind of national treasure, but tonight he's ours.
Bob, thank you. Great introduction. Except for the 2014 part, Barb just fainted. That's my wife, by the way, when she heard that I was running for my seventh term, which she just heard tonight for the first time. That's not the way to announce one's reelection. I just want you to know that. But thank you for the plump, balding, and disheveled reference, too. It It helped actually reelect me, and I'll tell you, since Bob brought it up, I'll tell you the story of my second reelection, or my second run, which was my first reelection. I was running against an astronaut. Someone want more coffee? Hot tea? Anyone want tea over here? Raise your hand. This was a guy whose name was, his name was Jack Lausma. Real nice guy. He'd never run for office before. And he was running against me in 1984. So Reagan was in office, very, very popular. I had just voted against the Reagan tax cut because I thought it would be a bad mistake and was unfair and get us into a deficit ditch and all the other reasons. But I was only one of, I think, seven or eight senators that voted against that tax cut. And so I was in big trouble. That's just the Reagan tax cut. Wait till we get to the Bush tax cut. That comes later. Anyway, so Lausma put out his political literature. And in this literature, it started off with his physical characteristics. Now, this is an ex-astronaut, military guy, and he it was done innocently, probably, and I never suspected anything else, but he starts off with physical characteristics in political literature. 6'3", 195 pounds, blonde hair and blue eyes. Now, my staff immediately said, that's secret for you're Jewish. And I said, I don't think so. I don't think so, but let's have some fun with it. So I got a piece of that literature, and at my next speech, I said, now my opponent has put out this literature with his physical characteristics. And I went through what they were. And he said, there's a lot of people worried about this, but I don't think so. We've checked with our pollster. And our pollster says that what we should do is put out our literature with my physical characteristics. 5'9½", plump, balding, and disheveled. And then I said, our pollster says it's a winning strategy because, folks, there's more of us than there is of them. That's my plump, balding, disheveled story. But it actually probably helped help me win because people like a sense of humor, I think, and they don't want to take politics too seriously, even though it is getting serious indeed. We met last, I guess, 5 years ago. I don't know where our dinner was, but I was talking about the U.S. Senate at that time. And so I guess the question is kind of what's the things any worse since then or better since then? And is it really as bad as it seems? Have things gotten worse over the last few years? More divisive, more nasty, more intensively negative? And my answer is that is not really the problem. It's not more partisan than it's been. It's not more divisive than it's been. It's not actually less civil than it's been. And I could go through some of the political campaigns of the past, which are incredibly uncivil. What has changed is that the people who were just elected, particularly the so-called Tea Party people, are almost religious in their zealotry against government. They are excessively zealous and are willing to bring down the government, literally, and are literally willing to destroy or take a risk of destroying the full faith and credit of the United States on the question of whether we increase the debt limit or not, unless they get their way on deficit reduction. That's what has changed. That these folks, it's not just the new folks that they are committed, hopefully are all committed. People have been committed in the past, but we've been able to compromise our differences in the past. We've been able to work out our differences. I watched Strom Thurmond and Ted Kennedy work out their differences. You can't get two people more different than Strom Thurmond and Ted Kennedy. And yet, when they'd go at it on the floor of the Senate or go at it however they did it, they then would work out their differences because they realized that you've got to govern. You have to have a government that functions. And I've seen this throughout my career. I've seen people of very, very strong beliefs that differ with each other, but nonetheless we're able to compromise at the end of the day to work something out so we could keep this government of ours going. This new group both in the House and in the Senate. There's probably now four or five senators who basically, when they say that they are not going to vote to increase the debt limit so that we can pay our bills, or they're not going to compromise on the question of the budget so that we could keep the government functioning, literally, again, the government almost closed its doors. When they say they're not going to do that, they mean it. They are willing to light the match to set off the dynamite. As one of my new Republican colleagues from Michigan has said just a few days ago when I was up in northern Michigan, and someone said, well, what do you think about the new congressman from this district who said that, hey, if we're going to have a crisis, bring it on. That's the attitude. Bring it on. Instead of let's try to avoid it, it's bring it on. And this is going to be tested. It's going to be tested twice in the next few months. First on the debt limit question as to whether we're going to increase this debt limit. And we have a number of people who have drawn a line in the sand. I won't call them conservative Republicans because they are not conservative people. These are radical people. Conservative is an honorable label. You know, we've had some very tremendous conservative people who are fiscally conservative, who are conservative about going to war, who wanted to conserve our environment, who want to conserve our constitutional values. You can have conservative people who are more traditionally conservative, who I don't agree with philosophically in a lot of ways. My values are very different from even traditional conservatives. But these folks, particularly the so-called Tea Party group, are not conservative people. These are people who are literally willing to see government go under. Barb and I have recent experience with one of my colleagues. I have a new car, a Volt, and we've got to be able to plug that Volt in order to avoid using gas. It can run on either gas or electricity directly, but you got to have a place to plug it in. Where we live in Washington, we don't have a garage, so we can't plug it in. So a number of senators who have electric vehicles say, well, why don't we just get an electric plug in our garage? Well, this one senator has a hold on our bill to have an electric socket put into a Senate garage because that's big government again. There they go again with an electric socket. Cost $8,000. So our answer is, hey, we'll pay for the electricity and we'll pay for the installation. We're not trying to get something free. And so he says, well, but are you including the interest on the $8,000 that has to be saved? Yeah, we're including the interest. And finally I said to him, you know, I'll pay for the $8,000. Take it out of our surplus funds. He says, well, no, Carl, I don't want you to do that. The point of this being is that we have what is new, I believe, a significant number of members in the House and the Senate who are zealous in their beliefs to the extent that they will use the ultimate nuclear weapon. And the ultimate nuclear weapon is basically to have the government close down or not pay your bills. There's two types of nuclear weapons, and we're approaching one of them. And we have a line drawn in the sand, and even Boehner, who is not particularly one of the zealots, by the way, but even Boehner has said, we're not going to have any new revenues. And that is the test. And I want to talk about that for about five more minutes, and then I'm going to open it up to you. Because that's the issue. The issue is not whether we're going to reduce the deficit. We're going to reduce the deficit. There may be people in this room who say there's too much emphasis on deficit reduction, not enough emphasis on growing the economy. That may be true, but it's not the point. There's going to be deficit reduction. And I believe there needs to be deficit reduction, by the way, because I think it's unsustainable to have deficits this size. And for those of you who are Democrats, be proud. The last great deficit reducer was a Clinton administration with a Democratic Congress. That's when we reduced the deficit. How did we reduce it in the Clinton years? 1993, Democratic Congress, Bill Clinton. We decided we were going to do deficit reduction. We did it by both cutting spending. We reduced the size of every single government agency, except the Justice Department. and we increased revenues. We raised the tax on upper bracket folks, people over $250,000. We added about 3% to your income tax. We taxed everybody else through the gas tax. We raised gas tax about 4.5 cents a gallon, not for roads. In this one instance, we did it for deficit reduction. It worked. We had a very great economy during the Clinton years, and by the end of that 8-year period, we had 2 straight years of surpluses for the first time in about 50 years. So that's the way we did it. It was about 55% new revenues and about 45% spending cuts. What this group has said is there's not going to be $1 of new revenues or taxes, however you want to describe it. There's not going to be $1 of new revenues. That's the issue. That's where the fight's going to be. That's where the issue's going to be joined. That's where Democrats like me are saying we ought to have something closer to 50-50. If we don't do this, folks, if we don't do this right, we're going to do deficit reduction. If we don't do it right, you are going to decimate education. You are going to decimate health care for kids. You're going to decimate environmental protection. You can go right down the line, because the cuts that would be necessary to do this through the domestic spending route, the Republicans aren't going to cut the fence. They agree we're not going to touch entitlements for the time being. So if they put defense off the table, which most Republicans do, and they did in the House, defense ought to be on the table, by the way, when it comes to deficit reduction, and I can answer a question or two on that if you like. But the point here is that where Democrats and Republicans are clashing directly is on the question of revenues. And if you don't get new revenues in here, if you don't restore that upper bracket tax that we had in effect with Clinton, if you don't close a number of loopholes, which I'm going to spend a couple moments talking about, because you can close some loopholes without harming the middle class. If you don't do that, you are going to do major damage to what this institution is all about the future, about education. The Republican budget would cut, for instance, Head Start by 30 or 40%. Pell Grants would decimate. It would wipe out the job training programs. These are not 5% cuts. These aren't little tweaks. These aren't everybody sharing. This is a major anti-government approach on the part of these folks, because if they don't agree to new revenues, and they say as of now they're not going to do it, they're not going to do it. We're put in the position then of saying, okay, we will have to vote to cut all of our domestic programs in a massive way in order to keep us from destroying the full faith and credit of the United States. That's the position that they want to put us in. It's going to take tremendous leadership on the part of the president, using the bully pulpit to raise the revenue issue, the tax issue, and to talk about the need to restore that upper bracket tax and to do a number of other things on the revenue side, which we can do. But that's the battleground that we're in. And this is a life and death struggle. This is not a case of a traditional Congress where you got Democrats and Republicans squabbling, battling. You know, that's what we're there for. We're not too partisan. That's not the problem. Partisanship actually has a place. Believing in certain philosophical beliefs, exercising your will, trying to win elections on issues. Of course, there's excessive partisanship. That's not the issue. It's the overzealous behavior on the part of these new Republicans who are driving the entire Republican agenda in the House and can pick up enough support in the Senate to make our life difficult. So that's the good news. We'll save let me just say, I don't know, I've probably maybe gone on too long. I want to save time for some questions. But I want to just tell you a number of loopholes which can be closed. Because people say, yeah, everyone talks about loophole closing. But what does that mean? You know, some people say, just close loopholes and raise money. I want to give you some examples of things that can be done and should be done. First of all would be the subsidy to the oil companies. There's no justification for 5 major oil companies. That's a lot of money, by the way, just in that one thing. Secondly, We have now we have tax laws which actually give incentives to people to move their plants overseas. Right now, if you have a plant, an operation going on in one of our states, and you move it to Mexico or Korea or whatever it is, first you get deduction for the cost of the moving. Secondly, any profit you make, of course, is not taxable here until you bring it home. And there's ways of avoiding taxes even when you do bring it home. So if you have a company in a factory working here and making a profit, you're not taxed on it. But if you move it overseas, you make a profit here, you are taxed on it. You move it overseas, you're not taxed on it. Okay. But I want to just give you one little wrinkle on that, which is even worse. If that company borrows $100 million to build some huge facility down in Mexico or wherever, and again, the profit there isn't taxed till they bring it back, but if they borrow the money to build the facility, the interest that they pay on that loan is deductible now. There's a lot of things like this. Tax havens, and we got some experts in the room here, so I got to be careful. I try to be as accurate as I can. There's a place down in the Caymans called the Ugland House, which is a lot smaller, by the way, than Parrish, which has 15,000 mailboxes for shell corporations, which avoid paying taxes by opening up these shell corporations in these tax havens. We can end that. There's a bill to end it. It's my bill. President Obama actually co-sponsored this bill when he was in the Senate. We can end that. That's money owing to Uncle Sam. This isn't taxes, new taxes, added taxes, more taxes. This is just the taxes that Uncle Sam is owed and should collect. We can end that, but we have to pass a law which will put an onus on banks in this country not to work with any bank, no correspondence accounts, no credit cards with any bank that comes from a tax haven, unless that tax haven agrees to share information with Uncle Sam. So we can end it. I've gotten too technical. I see some of you already kind of... Usually if I look at my wife, she'll give me a signal. She's had enough wine tonight. She's not going to give me a signal. Anyway, I just want to close on a positive note. Somebody asked me coming in here, I just have one question. Is there hope? I knew exactly what she meant, and the answer is yes. There's hope for all kinds of reasons. One of them being what we saw here today, the kind of collection that we saw today, the speeches, our writers from our class did such a fabulous job this afternoon. The students that President Chop talked about, those of us that heard her, and she's a spectacular choice for president. I mean, that really gives you hope. This country is incredibly resilient. There's not many schools like Swarthmore, but when you come here for a day like this, you surely are given a lift up. So Barb has always told me to end my remarks with a positive, uplifting end. That's the only thing I had in common with Ronald Reagan, who said, leave him laughing. With that, I will close and be happy to try to answer your questions. Norm. What Norm has asked is whether or not there's two amendments in the House bill, I think you're referring to, in the Senate authorization bill. I'm chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Will they be in our bill? Neither one will be in our bill, that's probably the part you want to hear. I think what the Republicans have done on Guantanamo is so shameless. It is so demagogic. The idea that we can't try a terrorist in the United States, we can't put in prison under their language, we can't open a prison in the United States where we can place a convicted terrorist is pure demagoguery of the worst kind. So they want to keep Guantanamo open. They got the votes to do it because every Republican's going to do it, and a few Democrats will join them just out of fear. You got a few scared Democrats too that will vote that way. The other question, though, has to do with the question of whether we ought to have procedures for people who are detained, and on that it's a much more complicated answer. You need procedures, and we don't have them, and we're going to try to work out procedures which are consistent with our Constitution so that people who are contained at Guantanamo have the opportunity to challenge their detention. So, but I think the answer basically is one you would like. Yeah, turn this off, I'm sorry. Gee, I thought that would put a halo over my head. It doesn't do it, though. It's underneath. Is that better? Yeah. Do I need a shave? Huh? Okay. Yes. And the second question is, I don't know of any way that the president can set aside. We can appropriate emergency appropriations. Okay, we can do that outside of the budget. They're not on budget, they're off budget without getting too technical. But you still have to raise the debt limit when you reach the debt limit, even with the so-called emergency appropriations that are not on budget. So that doesn't help us. On the first question about whether the Republican Party's imploding, I'm not sure whether to be happy to hear that or unhappy to hear that if it's true. I don't think it's true. That's true. Well, I don't predict that they're going to implode. But the problem is twofold. Number one, I don't think it's going to happen. In the meantime, though, what I think you're driving at is that a lot of the Tea Party types are going to cost the Republican Party a lot of elections. That's why I'm a strong supporter of the Tea Party. There's times I'm tempted to send money to Tea Party candidates. The Democrats would not control the Senate right now but for the Tea Party. They knocked off. The Tea Party knocked off in Republican primaries three moderate Republicans last time that probably would have won. We would have probably lost control of the Senate. Yeah. So at any rate, I think that's what you're driving at, that I think they are significantly weakening the Republican Party. But in the meantime, there's a lot of damage that is being done, and that's the fear. I don't fear the long-distance piece. I do fear that damage that's going on right now with the kind of budget battles that we're going through. That's what I'm worried about, yes. 70% of the people believe that we should restore the upper bracket tax or raise taxes on upper bracket people. 70% believe that. What's stopping us from doing it? That's not a hard issue to frame. You don't want to sound like a demagogue. You don't want to sound like you're running against the rich. You don't want to sound like you believe in class warfare. On the other hand, you do want to believe in fairness, and you can phrase the issue in a way which is a fairness issue, and that's based on something else. And I feel pretty keenly about this issue. The upper 1% in this country have increased their share of national income in the last few decades from 10% to 25%. That's the wealthiest 1%, okay? The wealthiest 10% are now up to 50%. A big increase, by the way. Went from a third to a half in the last few decades for the wealthiest 10%. Now, there's ways you can say that. And by the way, the key thing to that isn't that just the upper bracket folks have done incredibly well, and the gap between them and middle income is obscene, and by the way, much greater than any other advanced economy in the world. No other advanced economy has gaps like that where the wealthiest 1% control as much as the wealthiest 1% do here and so forth. But the piece that everyone feels, even though in this country everyone wants to be rich, and so there's a little reluctance to raise taxes on the rich because everybody thinks, don't pass a estate tax, or they Republicans call it a death tax, don't call it an estate tax because I don't want my estate covered, and I want to be rich someday. Well, the estate tax covers about 1% of the estates, okay? But the middle class, and this is the point, the middle class in this country has lost significant ground. At the same time, upper-income people have gained significant ground. And everybody knows it, by the way. They feel it. Houses foreclosures, jobs lost, pension benefits reduced, income going down, give backs by people in their jobs. I mean, the middle class in this country has taken a huge hit. And I want the president, number one, to feel it, which I think he does. He knows it up there. I think he feels it in his gut that this is the case. I want him to find a way to say it without looking like he's uncomfortable. He's got to be comfortable, folks. Look, we got a terrific president, but he's not going to be something other than what he is. He is somebody who does not like conflict, particularly in the Senate. He didn't like conflict. He liked to work things out with Republican colleagues. I watched him all the time do this, and that's fine. But it's not fine now. At this point, he can no longer worry that someone's going to call him a class warfare warrior. And are we off the record? It's a little bit late to ask that question. Is somebody holding up some machine which is taking every word I say down and it'll... We are taping? Okay, well, then I want to be a little bit careful because I've had personal conversations with the president on this subject, okay, on this subject, and I won't then repeat the conversations. But it's important, I believe, he's got to feel comfortable, but he should feel comfortable. He should feel comfortable about those facts that I just gave you. That's not America. Where a few decades ago, the wealthiest 1% had 10% of the income. That's big enough. Now 25% of our national income. That he can talk about that, and the people will agree with that. But I think he's afraid of sounding like something that he's not, which is divisive. He is not a divisive person. He doesn't want to, quote, run against the rich. And that's... He's going to have to raise this issue. And the framing of this issue, it seems to me, is critical to the, I believe, success in terms of getting revenues, but it's also critical to his reelection. Yeah. Yeah. What Larry's asking is this really the onus on the president to deliver that kind of a message? And I'm not a great, quote, framer of messages, by the way. When every time I hear people talk about framing messages, I always say the most important part of any frame to me is authenticity. We get all these guys coming into our Democratic caucus explaining to us how to frame the message and what should the frame be on this message. And they're devising, they're doing polling and all this other stuff and saying, this is what you ought to focus on. This is what you got to say about Medicare. Or this is what you got to say about Medicaid. This is the way to frame the issue. And they may be right statistically in their polling. And I'm not going to argue with a pollster. My argument, though, is, and this kind of gets to your question, it's got to be authentic. It cannot be that someone hands you a message. They hand us messages all the time, and I ignore them all the time. If I'm not comfortable with them, I'm going to ignore it. I'm going to speak from my gut, period, because I think otherwise the public will sense that it's a put-together message rather than a from-the-heart kind of a message. Now, the president is the only one who can carry this message. We make speeches all the time. I mean, everyone asks us back home, and a lot of you ask me here, can't you get your voices heard better? You know, can't you get a stronger voice out there? We don't hear enough of you guys. This is for you few Democrats in the room. We don't hear enough of you guys on television with your passionate speech. These guys are walking away with the media. All we hear is Tea Party this. All we hear is Sarah Palin this. God bless her, by the way. I want to keep her out there. I don't want to hear anyone knocking Sarah Palin. Every time she opens her mouth, our prospects are brighter. Anyway, that's on the record, too, by the way, Gretchen. But anyway, so we do try. But there's only really one person who can put it together and be heard, particularly in this media world we got. Yes. Yeah. The most important part of the Patriot Act for me, much of the bad parts we got rid of, okay, in terms of like getting, you have to, for American citizens in the United States, you got to get warrants, period. Okay? American citizens' constitutional rights are going to be protected. You got to get warrants. The issue is there's a new technology out there. In fact, it's no longer a new technology. It's called cell phones. How do you get a warrant on a cell phone? That's the fundamental issue. That's what drove the Patriot Act, as a matter of fact, is that we got new technologies and guys who are conspiring to blow up our kids wherever they are in the world or whatever aren't talking on a phone that you can identify in a warrant, go to a court with a location. You know, with a typical traditional warrant, You've got to go to a judge and say, we want to get a warrant on a phone on that particular location. We had to change the law so that we could cover mobile phones, cell phones, and all this other new technology, and we've done it, okay? But you still got to get a warrant, but you can identify it in a different way. That's the most important. Then there were some excesses in the Patriot Act, which we thought we successfully did it, how the court would be chosen, who was going to be on the court, how long would a warrant from the court last. There's a lot of technical procedural stuff that I thought was basically fair. The whole issue on this renewal of the Patriot Act, which we just did, had to do with an amendment, which was a Leahy Amendment, which never even got voted on, which I favored and co-sponsored, which would have required, number one, a sunset, an early sunset of the Patriot Act, and number two, a reporting requirement on the Sunset Act. I favored both of them, but neither one of them really went to the substance of the Patriot Act. Both of them were kind of procedures within procedures, which were legitimate. And again, I co-sponsored Leahy, but then voted for the Patriot Act because I think we, number one, must have a realistic way of getting a warrant on somebody. Number two, people who are conversing overseas, who are not American citizens, do not have the protections of our Constitution, and so the rules about tapping conversations do not apply. And we don't have to go to, run to a French court to try to get a warrant if we think someone's doing something in France or whatever. But that's a broad outline. Let me go on this side. Yeah. The question is there much potential in reforming the tax code and eliminating or reducing deductions gaining money that way instead of raising rates? And the answer is relatively little. You don't want to do it on charitable deductions, for instance. Some people say get rid of charitable deductions. You can ask who's the wonderful woman here who introduced herself who's been doing fundraising for Swarthmore for 10 years, and she's in the room sitting right over there. Give us your name, by the way, again.
Ann Bonner.
Okay, so Ann, yeah. Ann's introduced herself to me later. She was 10 years you've been raising money, you said, I think?
25.
Oh, wow, okay. I get your vote on that, I think. Anyway, so you don't want to do it on charitable deduction. Mortgage, you could do it on mortgages beyond a certain amount. You could do it on that one. The second house is much more complicated. You can't believe how many working people have little cottages in various places, you know, and it would really affect real estate, by the way, tremendously. And the one thing you don't want to do right now is drive down real estate values in any way, because the bubble which really put us into the recession, that housing bubble, has got to, you know, once it burst, all of our values went down on real estate. Just about every one of our homes went down in value. And we can't do anything which will drive that down further. So the answer is there's a little bit of things you can do in that area, but it's not really a juicy target. And a flat rate is a very regressive rate. Middle-income people will pay a lot more money on a flat rate than they would on a rate with all kinds of deductions as we have now. Is it too complicated? Far too complicated. Some of the deductions that I talked about, we'd like to get rid of a few of those, but the ones that I think you're talking about probably is not a very rich field. Bobby. Well, but everyone else considers himself middle class. So I don't think there's much difference on this one. I really don't. Everyone below that level. In fact, let me tell you, a lot of people making 250 grand consider themselves middle class. I would say most or maybe half of my Democratic colleagues don't want to restore the 3% down to 250,000. They would prefer a millionaire's surtax instead of that. So, you know, I'm taking a risky position politically just talking about the rates that Clinton had down to about 250,000. But to answer your question directly, most people, other than folks who are obviously in the upper bracket, do consider themselves middle class. That's sort of the dream, and that's what most people consider themselves. Now, I think that's true. I think that's true, but we think we do speak to those interests pretty clearly. Interestingly enough, a lot of those folks are attracted by so-called social issues instead of economic issues. It's kind of amazing that some of the poorest people in this country who's unemployment insurance is running out, because in my state, for instance, our new governor has reduced the number of weeks of unemployment insurance by 6 weeks. It's unthinkable to me that we would do it in the state, and yet a lot of those folks, if they go to the polls at all, will be voting on things like, well, you know, the NRA says that you're going to take my gun away, or some other, or an abortion issue, for instance, which was a big issue in Michigan because of stem cell research. So you're absolutely right. We've got to appeal to folks who are unemployed and really in a lower income category. But the big independent group that swung last year, 2010 was it, I guess, those folks are independent group, most of whom consider themselves middle income people. Yeah. Uh-oh, I think that's a signal for me to get out of here. Yeah. Not the upper 1%. Half the upper 1% are probably agree with me, by the way. I mean, you got some of the wealthiest folks in the world who would say, yeah, there ought to be an estate tax. You know, Bill Gates' dad is always, Warren Buffett's always quoted. These guys believe that there should be an estate tax. So they're not going to do anything different because we restore the Clinton 3% bracket for over 250,000. I don't think that possibly is in the cards. Ooh. Right. This is a very important point about feeling of a lot of folks who are Tea Party supporters who feel that intellectuals, Democrats, liberal types, progressives talk down to them and don't understand their perspective, aren't listening to them, and that they have no way really to express themselves except by supporting people. And it's not a quibble. It's more than a quibble. My problem is not with those folks. My problem is the candidates that take advantage of those folks. That's my problem. Okay, I don't have any problem with someone coming up here. So I'm losing my house, Senator. You know, and you guys are spending money like crazy, and I'm losing my house, or I lost my job. I understand that. By the way, we all ought to understand that, and we ought to. I agree with you, and we have to show some real respect for that. There's a lot of pain out there. Would cost Democrats this last election, I believe, was basically the pain that was out there wasn't government spending. It was home foreclosures and unemployment, basically, and people who are afraid. And these people, I don't care whether they're poor, middle income, or what, need to be respected and need to be listened to, because that is what they are telling us, a lot of people. And we must address those real feelings. Those are honest human feelings. You know, the foreclosure rate in this house and in this country is unbelievable. So I happen to agree with what you're saying. Yeah. And I think communication, but the first thing, respect. Communication is critically important, but it's the first thing that you got to do is really respect the anger and understand the anger that exists out there. People, you know, it's resentment. Well, put a one word on it. I'll repeat it. The question is, Biden's running, has a group of about five people who are trying to put together some kind of a compromise on the question of raising the debt limit. He's the perfect person to pull it off. He's very likable, and he understands the need to compromise. He's been in that position for a long, long time. And so he's the right person to do it, and I'm hopeful that he'll succeed in doing it. But my hunch is at the end of the day, it'll be the president and probably Boehner who will have to get together. Now, they have a big golf match coming up. I think you've all read that they have a date to play golf, and so maybe that'll do some good. Keep your optimism. Keep your faith in this country and restoring balance in this country. The wheel tends to turn in both directions, and a lot of people get discouraged too easily, and I think history shows that we can get back and scramble back to our feet. Little events can have major consequences. The capture or the killing of bin Laden had huge consequences, by the way, for this president too. Just that one event has huge reverberations in terms of his political future and the attacks on him, which have subsided. You know, it's kind of hard now to accuse him of being too thoughtful. That was one of the attacks on President Obama. He's just too thoughtful. He weighs pros and cons all the time. Anyway, this isn't quite your question, I know. But I would say understand that, accept the fact that that things bounce back, things change, and these are all very general comments, but don't assume that we can't solve our problems. Don't give up. Well, this is all kind of Sunday morning stuff, or for those of us who are Jewish, Saturday morning stuff. But that's really what I say. In each of our cases, you know, probably everyone in this room is involved in different ways in all kinds of activities, volunteer as you are trying to stimulate so well your activities. Volunteer activities are important. Everyone can make contributions to their own community in different ways. It's kind of hard to come up with any sort of a recipe that would apply to everybody. That's not true. I don't think so. I hate to tell you don't write the president. It's kind of silly for me to say that. But that's not really what would do, I think, the most good, probably. That's a very politically incorrect thing to say, but it's not the first politically incorrect thing I said tonight, so, yeah. Well, defense spending in general, that what we're doing right now is what we call scrubbing the budget. As we're meeting here, my staff in Washington is going literally this weekend, because we're going to have to start marking up, as we say, the budget end of next week, beginning of the week after, which means we're going to take the budget line by line and go through it, and we are going to make cuts in the budget. Now, the Republicans in the House, at least on the authorization bill, not only didn't cut the budget, they increased the budget above the president's current request. This gets awfully complicated, but the president's formal budget request was up here, but after he submitted that a few months later and the deficit issues became so intense, the president proposed a $400 billion, I think, reduction in between three or four agencies, including armed services. And so the president has reduced the request now. He won't give us any details. He won't tell us where, but the overall big number, he's told us he wants basically a cut by maybe $150 billion in 10 years, though. Not in 1 year, 10 years. So, bottom line, we are going to reduce the defense budget in the Senate. At least our bill will reduce this budget. We're going to do it, though, not with a percentage. We're going to... You're trying to get out and have some fun tonight, aren't you? I'll bet those guys have got dates tonight. Yeah. Okay, anyway, we're going to do... We're going to do it. We're going to reduce the defense budget, and we're going to do it line by line. So it's not we're cutting 1%, 2%, 3%, because that's not a very rational way to budget, frankly. So there will be an effort. We're going to succeed. How big it'll be, I don't know. The biggest issue, for those of you who I think are worried about some of the what you're talking about, is what's going to happen with the number of troops in July in Afghanistan. Now, this isn't your question, but I want to talk about this, because I spent a lot of time on this issue, and with the president, a lot of time on this issue. Right now, we got 100,000 troops in Afghanistan. 30,000 of those troops were surged into Afghanistan about a year and a half ago when the president made a speech at West Point. We had then had 70,000 at that time, and the president said he wanted to add 30,000 more. And he said something else. We're going to begin to reduce the number of troops in July of 2011. That's next month, folks. Now, there's a lot of pressure on him. I happen to disagree with the surge of 30,000 for what it's worth, and publicly I took the position that we should not increase our footprint in Afghanistan. We should send in many more trainers, train the Afghan army, which is well respected in Afghanistan, to take the security in their hands, because it's a respected group, and the Taliban is hated in Afghanistan. You put those two things together, an army that's respected and an enemy that is hated by the people, feared but hated, you got real possibilities. But it's not helpful in my book to send in more and more foreign troops. It's helpful to train more and more Afghans and equip more and more Afghans. Anyway, that part of his speech I disagreed with. But the July 2011 part of that speech is critically important. And I talked about what the cutting edge was on these budget discussions. We talked about revenues. That's where the rubber hits the road on that issue. Will there or won't there be revenues on the budget, okay? On this issue, defense, size of the military, including size of the budget, the president's decision this month as to the size of that reduction is critically important. Most of the military leaders want it to be symbolic, a few thousand. Most of us want it to be, most Democrats, I should say, want it to be significant. That's the battleground. And that has an effect on the budget. And one of the issues we're scrubbing is what effect on the budget would it be if he takes out 5,000 or 15,000 or 30,000 or what is the number? That does have a big effect on the budget. And by the way, I just got back from Guam and Okinawa. I do a lot of traveling in Japan on the question of our overseas bases and our overseas deployments and the huge cost of that. We are moving 10,000 people from one part of Korea to another, building family housing for them, by the way. And listen to this. The rent we're going to pay for that family housing, that new housing that's going to be built, maybe, unless we can stop it, which we may be able to, is $6,000 a month for military families. We're moving them from one part of Korea to another. That's the kind of thing I'm spending a lot of time focusing on. There's a huge amount of money there. We're spread out way too far. We got too many bases. So I spend a lot of time on those items, and that's why Barbara and I have so many frequent flyer miles that we every 10 years can get a vacation. Well, should we take one more or give it up so these young folks can have some fun tonight? Okay, one more. The president, the deal, and it's kind of hard to talk in terms of a deal because it's really a decision of a commander-in-chief, but it was based on a deal, that there would be a reduction in troops beginning in July of this year, which, remember, was a year and a half after the announcement at West Point in December of 2009. The understanding deal order was that the degree or the extent of reductions would be based on conditions that existed on the ground. Not whether there would be a reduction. This was the battle a year and a half ago. Not whether there would be a reduction. That was decided. The president, commander-in-chief, we are going to begin to reduce troops July 2011. That's the end of that debate. The extent of the reductions, the pace of the reductions, I think was the word they used, would be determined by the conditions on the ground. I believe the conditions on the ground. So there's no violation going on here by the military pushing back, saying it ought to be symbolic, that things are going not as fast as we'd like. They can make that argument. Now, I think the conditions on the ground are ripe for a significant reduction, by the way, for a number of reasons, one of which is the growth of the Afghan army has been terrific, way ahead of schedule. Their capability is solid, not great, but solid. And we are able to turn over responsibility to the Afghans for their own security, which is the thing the Taliban dreads the most, the greatest fear they have. Their nightmare, the Taliban nightmare, isn't us in Afghanistan. We're the target for them. We're the propaganda for them. We feed their propaganda when we are there. Their nightmare is they are up against an Afghan army, which is willing to fight. Let me tell you, Afghans know how to fight. And that's the Taliban nightmare. So I think there should be a significant drawdown, and I've urged the president to make it significant. And he'll get divided advice on it. And you have to understand, you got a fairly young president, no military experience. He did wonders in terms of that with the bin Laden episode, by the way. I don't think anyone can accuse him now of being weak and all the rest. He's now past that. But nonetheless, he still, I think, views himself, and this is my guess, as being somewhat vulnerable in this area, and that he wants to have the support of Petraeus and Mullen and these other leaders in the military, and that's understandable. We have to understand folks who are in the kind of position that the president's in. It's good that we push him and prod him and all the rest, but we also need to understand the situations he's in and what those limits are. Those of us who like to push those limits should push those limits. And I guess whose question was it as to what we could do to influence the president? You know, it may not be a letter, but find some other way with people who are close to the president, with your own members of Congress, particularly those who might be close to the president. Urge them to press the president in the direction you want. That'll have a bigger effect on the president, by the way. Not a letter to the president, and I answered that too glibly, and I didn't have this better formed answer at the time in my head. The better way to do it would be with your own, if you have a representative or a senator who does have impact on the president, that's the person you ought to work with and urge your message on that person. Well, it's great being at Swarthmore and great being with you.